This is Kathy coming to you with the Pantograph for Monday, the 22nd of December. Starting with the front page, giveaway event looks to kindle the spirit of kindness in youth. There's lots of pictures here. Young kids. Jamal Thomas sets down his 4-year-old son Keelan after saying how kind the boy is to everyone around him on Saturday at the Animal Bradley E. Kindness Organization giveaway at Woodhill Towers, where Bradley Ross, a Bloomington Normal native and current sophomore at Morehouse College, gave away gift cards with kindness reminders to local youth. And she has a youngish man holding a young child. He's a 4-year-old. And then there's a picture of Madison Thomas, who's 9, who reads a kindness message to spread kindness the way people spread rumors on Saturday at the annual Kindness Organization giveaway at Woodhill Towers. And the other picture is Jade Lechuga Diaz, reads a kindness message that says a smile can go a mile on Saturday at the annual Bradley Encourages Kindness Organization giveaway at Woodhill Towers. And, of course, the kids are all dressed in bright colors. This headline on the front page from Energy Illinois report, shortfalls stock grid's future, demand driven by data center development and retiring generators, by Jerry Nowicki. Illinois' electric grids may soon face power shortages and further price increases as fossil fuel plants go offline and data centers fueling the rise of artificial intelligence demand ever increasing amounts of power. That's the conclusion of a new report by 3 state agencies that foreshadow an upcoming state grid planning process and how lawmakers will regulate power-hungry data centers, if at all. The projected shortfalls would begin in the Commonwealth Edison service territory in northern Illinois by 2029 and in the Ameren service area that covers most of downstate Illinois by 2031. They continue to worsen and make Illinois more reliant on energy imports without action by state policymakers or grid operators. The challenges emerge from a combination of factors at the regional and national scale, the report noted. Load growth is accelerating, driven by data centers, transportation demand, and industrial expansion. At the same time, many coal, gas, and oil units are planned to retire, across both RTOs, which stands for Regional Transmission Organizations, due to age, economics, and emissions limits. The warning from the Illinois Power Agency, Illinois Environmental Protection Agency, and the Illinois Commerce Commission came the same week that prices once again rose at a procurement event in the area that serves northern Illinois consumers. Advocates behind recent renewable energy reforms and the governor who says he will sign them argue the report's findings prove that a plan passed by lawmakers in October was essential to avoiding a potential crisis. The state set up a deliberate process to address findings from this resource adequacy study and ensure that Illinois continues to lead the country in delivering a clean, reliable, affordable energy future for all, Governor J.B. Pritzker's office said in a statement. Critics, including the state's manufacturers, say the report makes clear that Illinois' decarbonization policies were overambitious. We didn't need a 222-page report to tell us what we already know. Illinois is facing an energy crisis resulting from the forced closure of dispatchable baseload generation and growing demand, Mark Densler, president and CEO of the Illinois Manufacturers Association, said in a statement. Grid planning and capacity. Warnings of the potential shortfall were contained in the most recent resource adequacy report that the state regulators are required to file under the Climate and Equitable Jobs Act, or CEJA, energy overhaul passed in 2021. The report, published Monday, precedes a mitigation planning process to be undertaken by the Illinois Power Agency. One of the marquee measures in CEJA called for taking all of the state's fossil fuel generators offline by 2045, but the plan also created the less heralded resource adequacy process to assess whether that timeline is feasible. While the resource adequacy report didn't specifically call for walking back SAGE's mandatory 2045 fossil fuel plant closure timeline, that possibility could be considered as regulators prepare the mitigation plan and embark on another major grid planning process in 2026. But even if Illinois delays closure dates, it's going to need new generators, the report noted. Another measure the governor has pledged to sign, the Clean and Reliable Grid Affordability Act, aims to add battery generation to the grid while creating other energy efficiency and planning processes. CRGA, Illinois' third major energy and decarbonization bill passed since 2016, requires the Illinois Commerce Commission to conduct an integrated resource planning process in 2026. The report noted the goal is to provide a more comprehensive venue for addressing many of the foundational issues in grid reliability. While this study underscores serious challenges, Illinois has already taken steps to address resource adequacy, a problem the entire country is facing, Solar Powers Illinois, an advocacy group for the rest of the state solar industry that backed CRGA, said in a statement. The group added that integrated resource planning will be a transparent, data-driven process to evaluate supply and demand, identify risks, and secure cost-efficient solutions. Problems go beyond Illinois. While Illinois will begin that planning effort next year, the issues facing the state's grids are not unique. The two multi-state, federally regulated regional transmission organizations that serve Illinois, PJM Interconnection in Northern Illinois, and the Mid-Continent Independence System Operator everywhere else, face their own challenges with out-of-state plant closures and growing load demands. At any rate, the report noted, if the grid can't replace retiring resources in a timely fashion, it would increase grid strain and lead to higher prices at capacity auctions, a cost that would be borne by the consumers. If regional markets remain short, Illinois will face persistent high-capacity prices, even if it builds new resources in-state, the report noted. PJM serves 67 million customers in 13 states and Washington, D.C., including 4.2 million Commonwealth Edison customers in northern Illinois, making it the largest grid operator in the U.S. On Wednesday, it announced the results of its most recent auction for capacity, which describes the payments that ratepayers make to power generators to ensure grid reliability. Capacity charges make up roughly 20% of a monthly power bill. The price per megawatt day at the most recent PJM auctions hit a record of $333.44 for 2027-28. Up $4.27 from the previous year, but still 11.5 times higher than just 3 years prior. The Citizens Utility Board, an Illinois consumer advocacy group, said the news shows the capacity market is breaking under the weight of data center demand and a dysfunctional interconnection queue. PJM's interconnection queue largely dictates how quickly new generators can come online, and advocates and the governor have long called for reforms. The report noted it has improved since PJM created new processes in 2023, but it still takes 5 to 7 years to get gas turbines online, while siting and permitting can also cause delays. The report also noted supply chain disruptions, tariffs, and domestic content requirements for tax credit eligibility could also delay wind and solar coming online. Without real reforms, in just a few years, 67 million electric customers in the PJM footprint would face rolling blackouts and an escalation of power bills that make the current price spike seem tame, Cub Executive Director Sarah Moskowitz said in a statement. The report's recommendations. As fossil fuel plants in Illinois go offline due to CEJA's mandates, it could make the state reliant on importing energy from other zones within the regional transmission organizations, even as the RTOs themselves face shortfalls. Because of that, the state will need new generation, even if Illinois retains a portion of its existing thermal fleet. To address the potential shortages, Illinois must employ a diversified resource strategy, according to the report. This includes combining continued growth of new in-state wind and solar supported by IPA procurements and programs, greater use of existing and planned transmission to import power from MISO and PJM when available, and continued use of fueled thermal generators as reliability assets, even as their energy output declines with higher renewable penetration, the report noted. Other potential resources cited in the report include green hydrogen, nuclear fission reactors, utility-scale solar, onshore wind, and 4-hour lithium-ion batteries. The CRGA, which passed the state legislation in October and the governor said he will sign, creates a new incentive structure for energy storage projects, similar to how the state funds renewable developments like wind and solar power. Data centers and advocate response. The advocates behind CRGA say it was passed in large part because lawmakers understood the trends that were outlined in this week's report. But renewable energy advocates like the Illinois Clean Jobs Coalition and consumer advocates like the CUB say it's just as essential to regulate power-hungry data centers. The next critical step is to pass common sense guardrails for data centers. The primary driver of the unprecedented energy demand that is saddling Illinois consumers with rising utility bills while dirty energy companies make record profits, said Clean Jobs Coalition said in a statement. The influential coalition, which includes union, faith, and environmental groups, said it will work with lawmakers to ensure data center developers, not Illinois consumers, pay for the disproportionate energy burden that big tech is bringing to our power grid. Pritzker's office didn't directly respond to questions about what data center regulations, if any, the governor and lawmakers will consider in the spring. Illinois has provided tax incentives for data centers since Pritzker signed bipartisan legislation in 2019. According to the state 2024 report, 27 data centers had received incentives totaling $983 million in tax breaks and benefits. The National Resources Defense Council estimated that data centers will drive up costs for PJM consumers by another $163 billion through 2033 and increase monthly bills by about $70 by 2078. The Citizens Utility Board called on PJM to clean up its interconnection queue while urging states to force data centers to reduce operations or use on-site battery backup systems when electricity is in high demand. Advocates also called for the renewal of a proposal requiring data centers to power themselves with renewable energy, which stalled in the spring. Data center companies are among the wealthiest in the world, and it is simply unconscionable that customers should pay unbearably high power costs to foot the bill for data center energy-guzzling, Moskowitz said. The Manufacturers Association have long called for a repeal of CEJA's closure date to reduce uncertainty. The group called for an all-of-the-above approach that includes keeping fossil fuels online. If skyrocketing power bills were not warning enough, this new report is a flashing red sign that Illinois needs to act immediately, Densler said in a statement. With electricity demand only expected to increase, we simply cannot risk the chaos that would be caused by the premature closure of baseload generation plants as required under current law. On page 2, crowd greets solstice at Stonehenge. Thousands of people cheered and danced around Stonehenge as the sun rose over the prehistoric stone circle Sunday and the winter solstice. The crowds, many dressed as druids and pagans, gathered before dawn, waiting patiently in the dark and cold field in southwest England. Some sang and beat drums while others took time to reflect among the huge stone pillars. Many make the pilgrimage to the stone circle every summer and winter and consider it a spiritual experience. The ancient monument, erected between 5,000 and 3,500 years ago, was built to align with the movement of the sun on the solstices, key dates in the calendar for ancient farmers. English Heritage, the organization that manages Stonehenge, said about 8,500 people celebrated Saturday at the monument on Salisbury Plain, about 75 miles southwest of London. It added that its live stream of the festivities drew over 2,402 visitors from around the world. Sunday is the shortest day of the year north of the equator, where the solstice marks the start of the astronomical winter. It's the opposite in the southern hemisphere, where it is the longest day of the year and summer will start. The winter solstice is when the sun makes its shortest, lowest arc, but many celebrate it as a time of renewal because after Sunday, the sun starts climbing again and the days will get a little longer every day until late June. And in the local news section, it's officially panic time. Okay, guys and gals, there are only roughly 3,500 minutes left until Christmas, depending on when you do Christmas. If you are not done shopping or preparing yet, it is officially time to panic. I'm right there with you. I kind of thought that as I got older, things like shopping for the wife would get easier. I mean, we spend about 355 to 360 days a year together, so I should know what she likes and wants, you would think. Part of the problem is that we are at a stage in life where we don't need a lot of things, and what we do need or desire, we just go out and get it or order it online. Also, after years of living, we have stuff, too much stuff for a lot of us. Then there are the wants or the desires, but a level we are both at, something so obscure or expensive or both that we don't feel comfortable buying it in case we get it wrong, as usually at this level it's hard to return the item. I mean, I would love to buy a professional grade camera lens for the wife, but I am not dropping $5,000 on something I know nothing about. She feels the same way toward my hobbies and ultimate wants. I don't think I will be getting an old master painting under the tree this year or any year. In my younger days, in the dating and early marriage years, I employed the shotgun approach to gifts, lots of stuff, hoping that some of what I acquire will be acceptable. I also knew that a few would be swing and misses. Now, these days, it seems too much of a waste, too much time and effort, and frankly, I want to at least try to show I have listened to her when or if she's hinted about something. Not likely. I am terrible about understanding hints like this. We spent the last few days decorating the house for Christmas, buying the tree, putting it up, dragging out the oversized boxes and tubs with all the house decorations and tree ornaments. There are some things we put up in the same place each year, so I put out some of those things. Other decorations my wife puts in a new nook or cranny. I don't ever seem to see these nooks and crannies. In fact, in these houses now, are there even any nooks and/or crannies? Some items, such as decorative doorknob cover, goes on the same doorknob each time. I did wonder this year why we decided that this Christmas mouse doorknob goes over on the same particular doorknob. I believe the first time we put it out many years ago, we just didn't know where to put it, so I plopped it on a random doorknob, and now that is its forever home. We have to be a little more mindful of where we put out certain items this year, as we now have a toddler grandchild who visits often with another one on the way, so this is going to be a several-year consideration when decorating. I wouldn't have it any other way. And that was written by Tom Horseth, who grew up in Normal, attended a U elementary through high school in Unit 5 schools. His wife is a native of Normal and an Illinois State University graduate. They now live in Minnesota, coincidentally living less than a mile away from a fellow Normal Community High School graduate from the same year. If you want more with Tim, you can send him an email to conversationswithtimothy.wordpress.com. And you can see what he thinks about the world. On duty, Washburn native proudly serves the U.S. Navy. Seaman apprentice Riley Jones of Washburn is currently serving the U.S. Navy, assigned to Maritime Expeditionary Security Group 2, or MESG2, part of the Navy's Expeditionary Force. Jones is a 2024 graduate of Loburn Washburn High School. He joined the Navy 1 year ago and today serves as an information systems technician. I learned how to be open and honest. I also learned how to talk to others, Jones said of the skills that he gained in Washburn in a news release. I joined the Navy because I want to explore the world. I've met so many new people. It's amazing. MESG2 is headquartered in Virginia Beach, Virginia, and delivers the Navy's front line of defense in coastal waters and ports around the globe. Its sailors are trained to patrol harbors, escort high-value ships, and guard maritime choke points where danger is most likely to appear. They work to ensure freedom of movement for the U.S. and allied forces in contested environments, whether they are operating from fast patrol craft or shoreside security positions, according to a news release from the Navy Office of Community Outreach. I haven't been in too long, but there's so many points where I could have given up. At this point, I'm most proud of getting through all my schooling and just being where I am, Jones said in the release. Serving in the Navy means exploring my opportunities and options. It's given me so many opportunities and allowed me to defend my country. Jones also credits his family for making his career possible. I call my family every weekend, and I'd like to thank them, particularly my mom and sister, who have always helped to calm my nerves during hard times. Additionally, all the mentorship I gained in the Navy has been incredible, he said in the release. I'm a big gamer, and I play the support classes a lot. The Navy has given me the opportunity to be a support, but in real life, I can support my country, the sailors around me, and the people back home.
World War II, Navy veteran.
World War II Navy veteran Schaub dies at 105. Chicago native survived the bombing of Pearl Harbor. By Jennifer P Peltz and Jamie Ding. World War II Navy veteran Ira Ike Schwab, one of the dwindling number of survivors of the 1941 Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor, has died. He was 105. Daughter Kimberly Heinrichs told the Associated Press that Schwab died at home early Saturday in the presence of she and her husband. With his passing, there remained only about a dozen survivors of the surprise attack, which killed just over 2,400 troops and propelled the United States into the war. Schwab was a sailor of just 21 at the time of the attack, and for decades he rarely spoke about the experience. But in recent years, aware that the core of survivors was dwindling, the centenarian made a point of traveling from his home in Beaverton, Oregon, to the annual observance at the Hawaii military base to pay honor to the guys that didn't make it, he said in 2023. For last year's commemoration, Schwab spent weeks building up strength to be able to stand and salute. But this year he did not feel well enough to attend, and less than 3 weeks later he died. Born on Independence Day in 1920 in Chicago, Schwab was the eldest of three brothers. He joined the Navy at 18, following in the footsteps of his father, he said in a February interview for Pacific Historic Parks. On what began as a peaceful Sunday, December 7, 1941, Schwab, who played the tuba in the USS Dobbins Band, was expecting a visit from his brother, a fellow service member assigned to a nearby naval radio station. Schwab had just showered and donned a clean uniform when he heard the call for fire rescue. He went topside and saw another ship, the USS Utah, capsizing. Japanese planes roared through the air. "We were pretty startled. Startled and scared to death," Schwab recalled in 2023. "We didn't know what to expect, and we knew that if anything happened to us, we would be it." He scurried back below deck to grab boxes of ammunition and joined a daisy chain of sailors feeding shells to an anti-aircraft gun above. His ship lost three sailors, according to Navy records. One was killed in action, and two died later of fragment wounds from a bomb that struck the stern. All had been manning an anti-aircraft gun. Schwab spent most of the war with the Navy in the Pacific, going to the New Hebrides, now known as Vanuatu, and then the Mariana Islands and Okinawa, Japan. After the war, he studied aerospace engineering and worked on the Apollo spaceflight program as an electrical engineer for General Dynamics, helping send astronauts to the moon. Schwab's son also joined the Navy and is a retired commander. Speaking at a 2022 ceremony, Schwab asked people to honor those who served at Pearl Harbor. "Remember what they're here for. Remember and honor those that are left. They did a hell of a job," he said. "Those who are still here, dead or alive." First Lego League Robotics Tourney Inspires and Challenges by Jack Alkire from Bloomington. 14 teams of school children were scheduled to compete on December 14th in the First Lego League Robotics Tournament regional qualifiers, but that weekend snowstorm forced a cancellation before the sectionals. Without a place to hold the tournament, the region would have to pick five teams for a lottery to advance to sectionals, said tournament director Harry Reba. At the last minute, Second Presbyterian Church in downtown Bloomington offered to host the teams and tournament on Saturday, December 20th, so the kids could practice their robotic skills. "It's an opportunity for these students to exercise their STEM activities that they've been working on," said field manager Chris Tabor. Tabor is also the leader of Team Metal Cow Robotics with McLean County 4-H. 13 of the 14 scheduled teams made it to Saturday's competition, with students in grades 4 through 8 participating, Tabor said. FIRST, which stands for Inspiration and Recognition of Science and Technology, is a global nonprofit organization focused on welcoming team-based robotics programming. Organization founder Dean Kamen and Lego Group owner Kjeld Kirk Christensen partnered to create this league in 1998 to engage children in playful and meaningful learning while helping them discover the fun in science and technology, according to the First Lego League website. In August, First Lego League announced the rules of this year's game, the specifications of the Lego robot, and this year's theme, archaeology. After that, teams interviewed real-life archaeologists to find out information about problems in the field. What's their pain points? What problems are they experiencing? Whether it's theft on their sites or money to continue digs or start new digs, Tabor said. Then they start problem-solving with robotics. Say a team of archaeologists is worried about trespassing and theft. You could station autonomous robots to set off alarms and trigger somebody in the field to either contact police or whatever crew that they want to go out there and check out the site, Tabor said. All of these robots were built using Legos and special robotics packs from the toy maker. One group developed a prototype smart trowel to prevent damaging artifacts in a dig. Team Spring built a walking robot with six legs that could cover different terrain while mapping certain areas. Beyond these innovation robots, each team built a field robot to complete missions in a simulated archaeological field site, also constructed with Lego bricks. There's teams competing around the world for this, Tabor said. So they're all using the same field. However, how they design their robot, there's no prescribed solution. Each field contained a series of tasks for the robots called missions, and the teams were scored on how well and how many times they completed each mission within 2 minutes and 30 seconds. Teams had the opportunity to switch out parts of their robots during the field test. All of this was announced in August so that teams could start building, testing, and learning before the tournaments, Tabor said. All of this was announced in August so the teams could start building, testing, and learning before the tournaments, Tabor said. After all, that's the whole point of FIRST Robotics, getting kids hooked on science, technology, engineering, and math, he said. I've always been a parent who's thought the schools can only do so much, Tabor said. I have no problem with them. They have limited time. This is a way to augment the students' education beyond the classroom. It's augmenting that education, getting them really hands-on experience, practical experience. FIRST Robotics has several age range classes from grade school through high school, and the students in Bloomington Normal have even been helping to teach kids in India, Reba said. We have 15 teams in India, FIRST Lego teams, Reba said. They are also planning to go for this kind of competition. FIRST has a presence in four elementary schools in the Bloomington area, Normal area, he said. Grove, Benjamin, Washington, and Tri-Valley, Reba said. Other schools are welcome to create teams, but parents need to be willing to volunteer to run the program, he said. And today's Flick Fact. What was so special about Abraham Lincoln's Christmas tree back when he lived in central Illinois? The answer. It's amazing to think about, but Abe never had one here because no one did. In fact, it was the year Abe left central Illinois to pursue the U.S. presidency in 1858 that the very first Christmas tree is said to have appeared in central Illinois, says McLean County Museum of History Archives. It wasn't, in fact, until the 1870s that Christmas trees became popular and commonplace in central Illinois homes. And how time flies. 100 years ago, December 22nd, 1925, the many friends of Miss Rachel Crothers, Bloomington's famous playwright, who recall her recent visit to Bloomington with much pleasure, will be interested to know that she will be broadcast from New York City on WGBS wavelength, the 315.6 at 6:40 o'clock tonight Eastern Time. 75 years ago, there was no room at the Normal Theater for about 175 kids Friday afternoon, as the theater was packed for Normal's annual Christmas party. Each youngster who was unable to get into the theater was given a theater ticket for any show during the next 2 weeks. 50 years ago, in 1975, Eldorado Road may now become known as Restaurant Row, if not in name, at least in appearance. A fifth company has announced plans to build a restaurant along that street of Oakland Avenue. The restaurant will be the Ground Round. And 25 years ago, in 2000, the City of Bloomington Township Board got its math right the second time around. The board, on December 21st, unanimously approved a $1.8 million levy for fiscal year 2001, roughly a 5% increase. On December 18th, the board, which is also the Bloomington City Council, approved a $2.1 million levy. A clerical error led the board, which voted unanimously, to erroneously sign off on a 19% increase in tax collection. The second vote nullified the faulty levy. A township attorney apologized for the error caused by basing the new levy on last year's budget. And that's be the end of part one. If you'll stay tuned, we'll be back with part two in a few minutes. Thanks.